Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the third episode of Ethiopian Adoptees, Unapologetically Unfiltered. Thank you so much for joining me. I am so excited to get into this episode. For many reasons, but one of them being that it is the start of, it is truly the start of the podcast in what I want it to be. I want the podcast to be something that centers the experiences of adoptees. I want that to be the foundation in which adoption, like conversations around adoption, is had moving forward. I really do. And that sounds kind of harsh, or is it just realistic? I'm not sure, but I think actually it's just overdue. Centering experiences of adoptees within the conversation of adoption seems like common sense to me. However, somehow our experiences often get pushed to the margins of that conversation. And because of that, I think, and I will, how I understand it to be and how I've experienced it, I think that is maybe one of the reasons why that the concept of adoption becomes overly glamorized, becomes idolized. It's kind of fantastical in a way. I think it's why when people saw all of us growing up, my parents always got, oh my gosh, you're a saint for what you've done. You know, you guys are such amazing people and all these things. And you kind of are pushed to the side, you know. And then it's like, I'm sure you're grateful and you're thankful. It could have been so much worse for you. And it's not even like those conversations when they're talking about you in a process that you've gone through, that, by the way, in no means would I ever describe, I would never glamorize the process of adoption. It was really confusing. It really messed me up in a lot of ways that I did not realize till even more recently. The more I think about it, it makes me really sad. I'm like, how did I go through it? And when you even look at the conversations, When the conversation of adoption was being had, I feel like often I was there and I was kind of pushed aside, and then it was about my parents and this good deed that they had done, and I was kind of on the side. And then when they would focus their attention on me, it became a conversation of, it's more of this just assumption. Oh, you know, you're obviously grateful. Obviously you're happy. Obviously it'd been worse for you. Looking through it in extremely Western, you know, westernized lens of good and bad and what's right and wrong. And at the end of the day, I don't think that's even a good excuse, because if I were to ask any of you, any of them, oh, you know what, how would I give, if I just pulled you out of here and dropped you in the small community in Ethiopia and told you, have fun, good luck. You know, I'm sure they'd probably be more accepting than my experience, but they'd be like, no, thanks. They'd be like, okay, so just even off that, it's like, why would you assume all these things? And at the very least, can you not even ask me, oh, how was it for you? It must have been messed up, as opposed to kind of just assuming it. So quite literally in conversations, and I'm not even sure if I'm doing this kind of example justice, but the actual conversation, the adoptee is shoved to the side. But it just is on the whole. And I think it just, In my mind, I'm like, oh, it's so glamorized. And there's no way it could be as glamorized and just made into this like fantasy situation. There's no way it would be that if people heard the experiences of adoptees. And that's not to say it would skew it to the other side where it beats the worst thing that's ever happened to any of us. But I think it would neutralize the conversation a bit. I think it would make it more genuine. I think it would just open up the conversation and make it more realistic. Because I don't think what I'm saying is crazy by any means. And that's what I want this podcast to be for adoptees and for all of those who are listening. For those of you who've reached out, parents of adoptees, adoptees themselves, you know, I've heard, you know, how necessary this conversation is. And I'm so grateful for those that are having this conversation. It's not hard. It'll get messy. It might even hurt your feelings, but that's the only way we can move forward. And for those of you who are, you know, adoptees reaching out from all over, thank you. I hear you. And I'm so glad that this is helpful. And it is necessary. It is overdue. And I'm so glad I can, you know, kind of just create a platform. Granted, I don't believe this is my doing. I think maybe this is just an outlet. And through everybody's contribution, I truly believe that this is a community effort and an opportunity for all of us to see and hear that, to hear adoption through a very realistic lens, through an honest lens, through an unfiltered lens, through an unapologetic lens. Because I feel like we've all lived a life that's quite opposite to that. And I think we are entitled to nothing less than unapologetically speaking our truth. So with all that being said, I am so, so excited to introduce all of you to our very first guest of many, many moving forward. And let's get into the interview. Okay, so our very first guest on the podcast his name is Bahailu Berry. And Bahailu and I are good friends. He grew up like 12 minutes away from me, so we didn't grow up like very far from each other, but we, you know, we had definitely times and years where we just didn't see each other with the way just life works, and it's so crazy. But he, you know, he doesn't live far away, and this was a great opportunity for us to connect. It was a great way to like really get to know him a little bit better, because there's a lot of things around our adoption that we know about each other, but there's a lot that we also don't. So that was great. Bahailu is he's 22 years old. He was adopted in 2007 from Wide Horizons, which is adopted in Addis Ababa, right in the capital of Ethiopia. I was adopted there. Many of our friends, they're also adopted from that agency. And it's funny, as Bahailu will point out, Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie also adopted their daughter from there as well. And I don't know, but I think I have some beef with Angelina Jolie, because what the heck, you know? I'm not serious. And I believe I don't think she was there. I think she had adopted her daughter well before I was even at the orphanage. But, you know, we like to joke about that once in a while. But so I think Bahailu's story is so incredibly touching. There are some similarities between, you know, our stories in terms of just kind of the impact of adoption and the way we've all kind of learned to cope with it, or the need to cope with adoption. Maybe that's what it is. That's this underlying similarity, and the way that in our own way we found ways to kind of create a person that's could handle adoption. You know, it's kind of it's very interesting how we've all kind of done that, and how we're both at our age. You know, we've had a bit of a conversation off the interview about just how we're at this age now, learning that, okay, you know, that version of us that we created that really did such an amazing job just getting through it all, did a great job, but it no longer serves us, and kind of learning to kind of rebuild it, or, you know, find the authentic versions of ourselves and whatnot. But thank you, Bahailu, if you're listening, for doing this, because this is not easy. You are the first person that's, you know, on this podcast coming forward and kind of telling your story, you know, with no blueprint, not knowing anybody that's listening, and just being so incredibly vulnerable and honest. And, you know, we talked about it, like, we both could have benefited from something like this. So, I thank you so much for, again, your time, your vulnerability, just how much care you had in what you spoke about. And, I hope you all just take a moment to, as you listen, to just to go back and work through your mental, emotional, psychological definition of adoption. I want you all to learn to center adoption in that conversation through the experiences of adoptees. So far, it's only been really my own, and then you'll hear about Bahailu's. And every time you listen, redefine that, because that definition is just so unfair. Unfair to the process, unfair to the adoptee, unfair to the reality of what it is at the end of the day. And by the way, thank you so much for being, you know, one of the first to kind of help redefine that, you know, the idea and the concept and the conversation around adoption, because it's so overdue, and it needs to be done, and it's not easy, and it really forces all of us to maybe relive things that we don't want to relive, to kind of open up Pandora's box. Because I know, even for myself, sometimes when I talk about it, I get off, stop recording, and I'm like, oh my gosh, like, that actually happened, and maybe I didn't address that, and wow, I really don't like that. And I see how it's super problematic, and it impacts me on a daily basis. And so it's a lot. It can be therapeutic, but it can also be really, 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 really difficult. So even for those of you that are listening, and when you do listen to these episodes, and it is, can be triggering in ways that you don't really even know, you know, maybe why that is, I urge you to take some self time for self-care, and maybe take a shower, or go outside for a walk, or just do something and that is helpful to you, and take care of that. Because no matter how much that narrative, the adoption is good, that it's fine, that it's whatever, no matter how much, you know, you've learned to kind of accept that, conversations like these that are almost so real that it can almost be shocking to the system, because then it opens up, you know, aspects of your life that you've kind of learned to block off. It's kind of like that you know, if somebody's is coming over to visit you, and I don't know why I'm thinking of this analogy right now, but and you're like, oh my gosh, I need to just kind of, you know, shove everything somewhere and put it away, and just because I'm having company over, you know. So you find that closet, you find that bedroom, you find that drawer, whatever it is, and you shove everything in there, and you just don't even have time to organize it. And then it's like, when everybody leaves, and you have to go back to that drawer, back to that room, back to that closet, and you have to inevitably, you know, kind of deal with it. And none of it, again, it's not organized, it wasn't put away nicely. And that's kind of, I think, what this podcast might do, if not, you know, eventually life will force adoptees to do, is, okay, you're shoved into this process, you're forced to go through this, and now you have to organize this on your own. And you're like, where do I start? Where does it go? And each, as you unpack it all, it's such a process. And this podcast, for some of you, might be that. And so if it is, take the time, and you're not being dramatic if you have to, because I honestly, if I'm being honest, I do it too all the time. So without further ado, I would like for you guys to meet and to enjoy Bahailu's kind of adoption story. And yeah, let's get into it. Okay, so I'm here with Bahailu Berry. Hi, Bahailu.
Hello.
And just to kind of
get started, like, right off the bat, what is your adoption story as you see it, feel it, and believe it to be?
That's a tough question to ask or answer, just because it, like, it changes as I change. Yeah, I think that at first, it was kind of just painful, really, to put it. Like, it was just, and this is difficult because I'm actually thinking about it on the spot.
Right.
Yeah, it kind of changed as I changed. So between 0 and 6, 6 and 12, and 12 to 18, up until now, it's just been, like, completely different the way I viewed adoption, myself, and anything that has to really relate with either those two things.
Do you want to start with the basics? So, like, when were you adopted?
So, yeah, let's go with that. I was adopted 2007 at the age of 6.
Okay.
And I was adopted from Wide Horizons. Yes. It's funny because up until recently, I always thought it was called White Horizons. And I don't know why.
You know, it's a little like...
That's what I'm saying, honestly. I don't...
Yeah.
So I found out recently, actually, that it's called Wide Horizons. So that's why there was a little slip.
That's funny.
But yeah, so I was adopted from Wide Horizons, which happens to be the same place that Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt adopted their kid. So around the same time, so I was, you know.
So close.
So really, yeah. That was the first thing. That's probably how I first felt about it. It was like, damn, I missed out.
Right.
That was probably the first way I viewed it. It was like, damn, as soon as I found out that they had adopted also from the same location, it was like, it was probably a little bit of envy.
Right, seriously.
Was there anything. Yep. And then, yeah, so, but that wasn't the only orphanage I went to. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I was born in the Hadia region in Hosanna. So that's about 5 hours away, I think, from the city, from Hadis. So, yeah, I went to, like, a local orphanage, and then from there, then I went to Wide Horizons.
Yeah. Do you remember much about, like, the early events, like, you going to the orphanage or, like, meeting your parents, adoptive parents, for the first time, any of that? Sometimes some of us block it out, you know.
It's bits and pieces.
Yeah.
It's bits and pieces. It's so scattered that it's hard for me to even, like, even now, as I have so many different perspectives on that kind of same story, whether it's from my adoptive parents or my biological family, even trying to weave a story through all of that, it's still kind of, like, difficult, just because I think everybody has just bits and pieces.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's specific things that I remember, and it feels like I remember very well. And then there's just kind of like just gaps. And I have some photos, which kind of help in terms of at least understanding how I felt. But in terms of trying to actually, I don't know, recreate what that was like, in terms of storytelling, anything like that, it's just so scattered, like, these memories. So, yeah, other than what I've kind of said so far, I went to this orphanage first, and then I went to the second one, and then apparently I'd only been at the first orphanage for a couple of months, and then the second orphanage for a few months, and that was about it. I mean, I couldn't have told you that. I don't know how long I was there for. I don't know how long it felt like. But yeah, so the first memory I have, well, I have a lot of memories from when I was young. Like, and so I have like a scar on my ankle, which kind of helped to remember one of them. It's funny to me now. No, it was a good one. So it's my siblings and I, my older brothers and I, we were playing soccer.
This is in Ethiopia.
When I was like 4 or something, we were playing soccer, and we finished playing and we went to the market, big market, like not too far away from my house, and I was just like, I was a kid and I didn't know how these things worked yet, so I was just kind of looking around and I saw some sugar canes and I didn't understand the whole concept of buying and paying or anything like that. But so I took one, and then I think, like, some a vendor or somebody was yelling at me, or maybe I just knew that it was bad. So then I started running, and apparently there was, like, this fire that had been going on. And so it had died down, but I couldn't tell, you know, because I was running away, and I was only, like, four. But it was still hot. There was, like, coal or something. Oh. And so I stepped in them, and I burned the crap out of my ankle. And then... Yeah, I went to my mom. I kept it quiet because I knew it was, some part of me knew it was, I didn't do the right thing.
Oh, yeah.
And so I went home and I kept that quiet. And then my mom, because I was whimpering at night, but my mom heard me like crying and making like these sounds. And then she asked like, what was going on? And then I finally had to spill the beans. And then she took care of it. She put like some mud, some clay on it, cooled it off. And then by the morning it felt good. And then there was some punishment for it because I had to tell her story.
Oh,
so yeah, it was just I like that memory so much because is she addressed the pain first and then you know then she dealt with the discipline and
yeah.
So it's a fun memory I have. I have a few memories like that, but in terms of or adoption and going to the orphanage, the way I remember it starting was. My mom and dad, they just brought me on a walk. I don't know if they like really how that kind of happened, whether it was like something planned or something kind of just, that they decided at the moment. But I remember thinking like, yo, this is kind of weird. Because I didn't spend that much time with my parents, like at all. My dad worked, all day, like we just didn't really see him, and my mom was usually at the church, and so I mean I didn't really see any of them. I would see my mom occasionally, but I would never really see them both together, like at least with just me. I would see them at meals, and holidays and stuff like that, but just kind of just spending both of their time only with me, it was just so strange. And so, yeah, we just kind of went on this walk, and it was just a long one. I don't know how far we went, how much time it took. Honestly, it could have been anywhere between an hour and a full day trip. We didn't spend the night anywhere, so it was somewhere between that range. But it could have been an hour and a half, or it could have been the whole day. And then anyway, so we get to this place finally, and... they have this, there was just this soccer ball, and I actually have a photo of it. There was just this soccer ball, and there was a bunch of kids playing, and immediately, I just ran off and started playing, just because that's just how it was.
Right.
And especially what was so noteworthy is that this soccer ball is like, it wasn't one just made out of socks and plastic bags, it was like an actual soccer ball, which I had never seen outside of TV.
Wow, okay.
So anyways, yeah, I ran off, I started playing with these kids, and yeah, that was that. I didn't see my parents again. I think that's kind of where the first memory ends. And then was there for a little bit of time. Then my parents, or my dad and my older brothers came to visit, I don't know how long after, and then I think that's when I was maybe told what was going on. I'm not really sure, maybe they just came to see me, but I have the photo, and I was just upset, of course.
That makes sense, yeah.
Let me find it. Yeah, it's actually right here.
That's the photo.
That's the photo, and that's the soccer ball.
I've seen that many times.
Yeah, that's the soccer ball.
Wow.
And so this is the fence of the first orphanage.
Wow.
And I was very upset. My siblings were smiling.
Yeah.
My dad is kind of like just calm. So I really don't know. Like, for me to piece out what happened here, I'm kind of like looking at this photo a lot and trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
And so I don't think. Maybe it was explained to me, but I definitely wasn't aware of what was going on or what any of it meant.
Yeah.
Because even this is way down the story, so I'll get to that later. Yeah, but the first orphanage, like, really sucked.
Okay.
Like, really, really sucked.
Remember what happened in there. Or not that you have to share.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it just sucked.
Yeah.
Like, so much so that it closed down.
Oh, wow.
Just because there was a lot of problems.
Yeah.
With it. And so, anyways, don't know how long I was there for. And then we were moving to the second orphanage. So they put us all in this car. I don't know how many of us there were, but there was definitely not enough seats in this car.
Yeah.
And it's about a 5-hour drive, and they gave us like this like biscuit thing. and I don't know if it was like a really bad biscuit or just because none of us had ever been in a car before. But we all threw up, so all of us. So there's that memory. And then, yeah, then we get to the second orphanage.
That's Wide Horizons.
Wide Horizons.
Yeah.
And, bits and pieces from here. Mm. One memory I have, and this is just because we got in trouble. There is this friend of mine, Tezabacho, I think that was his name. He's a little bit older than me, but we became very close. Mm. At least I think, and so we were bunk mates. So he was at the top on the left side bunk, and I was at the top bed on the right side bunk. And so we'd roll up a soccer ball or something, and we would just toss it between us. And I don't know if that was just like a thing we did every time. But one time we hit this chandelier that was in the middle of us. And we must have hit it pretty hard because it fell. And so that's another story that I have. I don't necessarily remember as well. I was just told this by the director once. Well, he told it to my adoptive parents, and they told it to me. But I do remember him. And then, yeah, there's a lot of videos that my adoptive parents took. So that, that kind of pieces things better from there. I spent a few days with them. My parents here, my adoptive parents, and then my biological parents came to visit one more time. And then we're on the plane, and my mom was giving me these like alphabet cards and trying to get me to learn English on the plane back.
Not even there yet. That's
crazy. I know. And then in the airport, of course, so I had to use the bathroom or whatever. While we're changing, I think I kept saying, is this like America? Because I'd never seen an airport. So I thought maybe this was the final destination.
Yeah.
And so that kind of just, I really had no idea what was going on even up until then. Then we arrived here and jump rope classes. Jump rope classes. That my parents, because it was the summer, I arrived here in, you're going to hate me for forgetting this, but I think it was like July.
Yeah.
July 11th. I think, just go with July 11th. June 11th, July 11th, something like that.
Yeah.
And so I arrived here in the middle of summer, so they put me in a summer camp just to socialize with kids because I was supposed to start first grade in September, and so they wanted me to just socialize. Very confused still. I don't know how long after I got here that I started that. Maybe a month. I remember I just hated jump rope classes because I couldn't understand what the hell this was. I just thought it was so stupid. Soccer, I completely understood. Soccer is, like, super comfortable for me. I picked that up. Like, yeah, there's a lot that has done for me.
Mm.
Jump rope, useless. I just hated it. Couldn't understand it. I kept hitting myself. And I just got super frustrated. So it's a joke that I have with my parents. I'll do anything, and I love learning stuff. Just jump rope is just never it for me.
No to jump rope.
And then, yeah, first grade and English as a second language teacher, meetings with her, and then lots and lots of soccer. And
can we talk about that? Because I know soccer has, and like I've known Baha'i Lu for like a pretty long time. We only grew up like, so I'm like 10 minutes, 11, maybe 12 minutes away from you. But like we would see each other like on and off throughout the years. But the one thing I did know pretty consistently, and my mom would talk about, and it's like, oh, Baha'i Lu, and it was you in soccer. Like you were always attached to it. And I feel like that was kind of your identity for a really long time. I could be overstepping, but maybe you can talk about the role of, even with like the story you just told, like soccer has such a,
I mean, like I said, like the very beginning of the story, like it started with me chasing a soccer ball and then getting separated from my parents and then not seeing them. And then chain of events happened. And then I get here.
Mm.
And so I think I just found a lot in soccer. Mm. I think just even from the very beginning, a lot of my memories, even the one with the sugar cane, that was after we played soccer, my brothers and I. And so it was just something that, I guess, stayed the same, like, through, like, a lot of change. Mm. So when I got here, I mean, I didn't know English. Nobody knew my languages. And so, yeah, I think it was just the one thing that actually made me feel, like I was still the same person, but still kept me connected. And so I put like everything behind that, like, and everything that, not everything that I have, but a lot of what I have is a result of, I mean, my friends, most of them, especially back then, the first, few years, all soccer friends, you know, just because you didn't really need to talk. So I couldn't talk really. And then when I could, it wasn't great at first. And, you know, then there's so many things, you know, just because emotionally and socially, they're a little bit intertwined. So, you know, there's a lot of things that I needed to process even back then. So it was very difficult for me to socialize. And so the whole like play dates and stuff like that, it was just difficult. I didn't understand how that was supposed to work. And so, yeah, the soccer was just kind of the thing because I didn't need to say anything. I didn't need to do anything. There was no like rules other than don't use your hand. And, you know, back then, that's basically it. So it was very easy for me to follow it and very easy for me to excel at it. I think as a result of that, you know, a lot of friends of mine, I guess at that point, originally just kids, they wanted me on their team because I was good.
Mm.
So there was a lot of, so I think that, you know, it was nice to be wanted and to be liked, and just because, you know, that wasn't really the case with playdates or just in the classroom, because I didn't understand how any of those things worked. So I'd always get frustrated with the class. I didn't understand what the teacher was trying to say to me. And so, I was just a little boisterous at first. And then, and then past that, middle school, I started to get a lot better as a result of all the time I spent. My dad here, he coached me for a number of years. And so that added to it. I just spent a lot of hours playing, and I got better and better and better. I was set to join one of the best teams you can in the area, around middle school, middle school. Mm. I had made the tryouts, made the team, I was set to start playing with the team in March, and then January my health started just getting weird. I just couldn't run anymore. That was kind of how it started. I mean, I used to play soccer, basketball every day, multiple games. I used to go to the indoor soccer facility and just hang out. I would be on a team. I would sign up for a team, but then, you know, I would have friends on other teams. They'd want me to play. So I would, you know, bring like 4 or 5 different shirts and I would hang out there all Saturday and Sunday afternoon. Mm. And I'll play multiple games. And then, you know, in middle school, I was on the basketball team as well. So I would have that. And so I was always active. And then just, yeah, I don't know how it started, but there was just this one practice where I just couldn't even do the warm up for basketball. And I was just like super confused, really. And so I was like, maybe I'm just tired. Mm-hmm. So I go home, don't really pay too much attention. I mention it, and then it's just kind of, oh, it could be the flu. It is flu season. Okay. And then so that goes on for a couple of weeks. And then around the same time, I started having these like nosebleeds. My nose would just start bleeding just randomly, like multiple times a day. And it would just keep going for hours and hours. And I would do everything. I'd lie down. I'd pinch it. I'd put ice on it. I even went to the hospital, and they thought it was because I was picking my nose. So they, like, they put some, like, hot metal or something, pressed it in my nose to, like, scab something, because there was, like, a little hole. And so they try to, like, burn that, and so that way it was sealed. So they even did that, and it just kept going and kept going and kept going. And then eventually I was just like, after a few weeks, maybe 3 weeks or something, I was just like, I don't know what this is. My parents didn't know what to do. They didn't know what this was. This wasn't a flu. It wasn't me just picking my nose and getting tired. Like, that wasn't it. Yeah. It's not
funny, by the way.
It is funny. It's funny to me now. It's funny to me now. Right. I mean, So we decided it was Valentine's Day, and I just kind of had enough, and so I just demanded to go to the hospital, and they first thing they did was they just like stabbed my thumb, took a little bit of blood, analyzed it, and then they said, okay, you need to go to this place, and so I went to the Exeter Hospital, from there, and then they actually took some vials, and then later that night they contacted me and they said, well, yeah, there's something wrong. And then they sent me to Boston Children's Hospital that same night. So my mom and I, I packed a bag and then headed there and then stayed there. They also did some tests and then they said, okay, you need to stay here longer for more tests. And then stayed there for, I don't know, it was probably between 3 to 5 days, I think, 3 to 5 nights. And then on that last day, yeah, they said, okay, well, you have aplastic anemia. And my mom, she was relieved because she was like, phew, I thought it was like cancer or something like that. And I don't think any of us really understood like what this thing was or how serious it was. And so at first when we heard what it was, we were just kind of relieved. Like, oh, okay, cool. And I remember I was like, okay, so like, do I got to take medication or what is this? I was like, are you going to give me an antibiotic? Like, what is this? Right. I was 12 at the time, about to turn 13 in March. So I had no idea what they were saying. Yeah, middle school.
Yeah.
They said, okay, well, what we need to do right now is we need to give you a blood transfusion. Your numbers are low. Your red blood cells are low. Your white blood cells are low. Your platelet counts are low. There's some other things, but those are the main three things. So the red blood cells, that explained why my hemoglobin in my red blood cells. So that explained why I was always so tired, is because I didn't have this like oxygen carrying protein to deliver into my system. So I wasn't getting enough oxygen in my blood and then obviously throughout the rest of my body. And then platelets, that's what, like, if you get a cut, that's what clogs it and kind of bandages you back up. And so I didn't have enough of those. So that's why my nosebleeds would last forever. And then once it was open, it just wouldn't close again. Maybe it would stop for a little bit, but you know, maybe like like a little bit. So there's maybe like a couple hundred of them, you know, just hanging out trying to close it. And then, yeah, the white blood cell count. So any cold, thank God I didn't get sick. But if I had gotten any type of cold, any type of infection, I would have had nothing to protect me from it. So,
wow, that's scary.
I had blood transfusions to get my numbers up. But I needed to, like, I wasn't creating this. So I couldn't just rely on a transfusion because they die, these cells, in a matter of weeks. And I don't know, maybe a matter of days sometimes too. I don't know. But yeah, so that was like a temporary solution. And then long term, I needed to get a bone marrow transplant from somebody that was going to be a genetic match. So this is where it gets really lovely, this story. Mm. So yeah, the chances of me finding somebody just randomly in the world, very tough. But if I have siblings, then the chances are increased substantially. So luckily, 2 years before this, I had gone in touch with my biological family. It was a closed adoption, but I just kept demanding it, to see them, to be connected. And so luckily my parents were very understanding and they started looking for them, I think shortly after I arrived here. And by the time, I think a couple years later, they found them. My dad went to go see them initially, and I stayed here. And then when I was 10, they decided that I was old enough to go on that trip. And I met them, saw them again, started kind of that rebuilding process in terms of relationship with them. And then 2 years later, we're contacting them, telling them, okay, I need your help. So, very, very fortunate that I had reconnected with them. And so anyways, tying this back to soccer, yeah, I couldn't play for a while. I think it was about 18 months. I was out of school for about a year, and I wasn't allowed anywhere outside of my house in the hospital. Couldn't go to any restaurants, couldn't really see anybody because of those main reasons. If I got a cut, it would have been bad. If somebody had a cold, it would have been bad for me, and I had no energy to do anything. And then, yeah, that's a whole thing. Getting back to the adoption part, yeah, that was something. That was something. It was kind of cruel because for such a long time, I'd always missed my siblings. I grew up two older brothers and a younger sister. So I was very close to my older siblings. And I was used to not being the only one at the house. And when I'm so here with my adoptive family, I have an older brother and two older sisters, but they've long since left the house when I arrived here. So I had siblings still, but I had my own room, and it was basically just my parents and I living at the house. So it was just a lot quieter. And so there was a lot of, when I was in Ethiopia, my older brothers and I, we slept in the same area, same bed. I was not used to sleeping alone, and that was really, really difficult for me. I was six. I used to spend so many nights just wishing that I had them here. And then as a result of this illness, and I was super excited as soon as they said, okay, sibling match, we need to get one of your siblings over here. I was actually super excited. I was let's go. It's not the way that I thought it was going to be, because I didn't have the energy to do anything and I couldn't go anywhere with them. And most of the time I was at the hospital even while they were here. So it was really difficult just because I had one of them here with me for so long. But now that they're actually here, everybody else in this town saw more of them than I did more with them than I did. And which was great, because now this town, a lot of my friends, they're Facebook friends with my older brother and my younger sister. They have their bonds there too, and it's great seeing them on Facebook, seeing comments. My older brother just graduated from college, so seeing a lot of friends of families saying congratulations and keeping it a happy birthday is great. But I was just super envious, just And just super envious and frustrating. There's so many. There's a lot of other emotions as well. So that was very, very complicated. That was very, very complicated. And so, and I mean, I hadn't even processed my first trip to see my biological family. And there's a number of stories, so I'm kind of going on tangents here now. But
that's great.
when I saw my biological family, found out that I actually, so when I had left, my mom was pregnant with a younger brother. So he was in the house now. So there was two older brothers, a younger sister, and a younger brother. And then, like basically as soon as I left, and then when I went to visit at 10, there was this like little girl just like walking around at the house, and I had no idea who she was, didn't recognize her. And so I asked who she was, thinking she was a cousin or something. And then it turned out to be that was my younger sister. I had another sister. So now my family got bigger. So now I had two older brothers. And then when I was there, it was two older brothers and a younger sister. And now it was two older brothers, two younger sisters, and a younger brother. And so that was just something that I was just kind of taken back by, just kind of surprised by. And I think I remember being very difficult for me. And so anyways, I didn't even process that. And now, you know, now that I have them, my older brother and a sister here, and the whole health situation and all that. And so that was, there just wasn't a lot of processing. And, you know, at the time, there was like fundraisers for me. And so I was kind of in the public eye. And so there was just a lot of like smiles that weren't really felt. It was just kind of, at least that deeply. I mean, I had no energy at the time I was going through chemotherapy, preparation. There's a lot of other things too. Just mixed emotions about having my siblings here. So I was, I was definitely, part of me was happy, but there was a lot of other things that I was feeling at the time. So it was just only this one thing could, there was only space for this one thing. And so, even after I got better, none of that was really processed. And so immediately threw myself back in soccer. That was like the one solution for me always. It always worked for me, even before my illness. And so I figured, okay, well, after my illness too. And so got right back into it, and I was just hungry. Like, as soon as I got the clearance, I just went on go. And I think there was just something about hitting such a low, like physically and in a lot of other ways, that kind of just fueled me. And now that my body had its capabilities, it took me a little while. There was this one thing, one camp that I went to, and I remember I just had to come back immediately after, just because it was probably more so a panic attack than anything physical. But anyways, I maybe a couple months after that, and that was like right after I had my transplant, maybe 2 months. My numbers were high enough, so I was able to just go to a camp, just run around and kick. But then like 10 minutes into it, I called my dad and I said, "You got to pick me up." I was like,
"Not ready."
Yeah, I mean, my lungs were on fire. My body probably, I mean, I had been lying down in bed or in a hospital bed for a long time. I was taking 50 to 60 pills a day. I had a central line in my chest connected to some aorta, maybe something connected to my heart, so that would, you know, pumping stuff in, it would be a lot easier. So I had that still in my chest. I was taking 50 to 60 medications a day, and I hadn't done more than walk in a long time. So yeah, physically I wasn't great. My number is the hemoglobin was high enough, so I should theoretically have enough oxygen energy. Anyways, just freaked out. But then after that, I just threw myself into it.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Because I know... No, I was going to say, this is great. And by the way, guys, Kylie's just free-flowing right now. So this is great that, you know, you're able to say as much as you are. But I know that, like, right after, like, high school started, and you went to Phillips, and after that, you'd go to Middlebury and Columbia, and it was just, like, academic weapon and everything else. But I think, like, you're talking about, like, chasing the soccer ball. You kind of chased the soccer ball through that too, right?
Yeah.
Would you say?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I went to, so I went to the local high school, and then I transferred after to a boarding school near me. And the, I mean, academically, I was okay, but that wasn't my main thing at the time. And so soccer was kind of the, it opened a lot of doors for me. And so I was able to transfer to a really good high school from there. And then I was able to commit for soccer to Middlebury. Played there my freshman years, was there in part my sophomore year. Yeah, it opened a lot of doors. Mm. Opened a lot of doors, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. No, and I think, like, soccer, I was just saying, because I remember, like, I thought it was just interesting, kind of, like, and it was like a metaphor, but at the beginning, you kind of said you're walking with your parents and you're like chasing a soccer ball, and then you just kind of kept chasing it throughout your life. That just kind of became kind of your story, part of your story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then there was, so yeah, my, up until really my sophomore year of college, that was like you said, I just kept chasing it. And then COVID took that away. The season was canceled, practice was canceled, and,
COVID,
and so now I didn't have the one solution to everything. So that got really, really difficult.
Yeah.
That got very, very difficult, because now I had collected all of this stuff that I had not been, like, touched, looked at all, or processed. There's just years of things I just never processed. And now I couldn't just, like, chase a soccer ball. I couldn't just ignore it, and just kind of fill up my time with something else. So, yeah, that got really difficult. And honestly, I'm still processing a lot of it now. But, yeah, it's difficult, you know, because 12 to 18, that looked different than 6 to 12. 6 to 12, it was a lot of anger, a lot of frustration. Yeah, mainly that. Wishing things had been different. And then after my illness, kind of, not initially, but over time, I kind of looked at it differently because of my health issues. You know, there's no cause for my illness, so I had to really think about it. The what ifs kind of stopped, because you know, I when I was younger, I always wished, like, okay, well, what if it was somebody else? Maybe it was my sibling. Why was it me? You know, and then after my illness, I was like, thank God, thank God it was me, because if I had stayed in Ethiopia, then I would have just died, most likely, and that would have been that. So, it just made me think about it so differently. And of course, I was still angry and I was still frustrated, but since there's no known cause, there's no way for me to know whether it was something internal. So regardless of where I was, whether Ethiopia or here, I would have been sick, or something environmental, whether it was a result of me being here. But most likely than not, since there is nothing that I can say concretely, then I'd have to expect that the same things would have happened if I had stayed there. And so, yeah, I made it very, I didn't process any of that until COVID, really. I was still angry. I still felt a lot. And I think I just kind of arrived at this point now where, I don't know, I'm just not doing the what ifs. I'm just not kind of looking back. You know, there's still a lot for me to process, but I I'm still in the process of doing that. But yeah, I hesitate to really say anything concretely, because probably in a month from now I'm gonna have a different opinion. I just kind of how things have been moving as of late.
That's okay too, you know, like, that's like, I think that's the whole point of this whole thing, is that, like, our adoption story changes wildly. Like, what I think today and what I think tomorrow
versus what I think 2 years down the road. It's completely different. I think the one thing that adoptees really need to, like, what they're everybody's entitled to is being completely okay with the fact that you can be pissed off and angry today and a bit more forgiving tomorrow. I want to set the world on fire in 2 months. And like, it's okay.
I think I needed that. So when COVID came, like I said, I wasn't playing soccer, so I didn't have any distraction. And so I think I needed to not have any distraction. Because now I'm at a lot better place than I was probably ever, just mentality-wise. And that wasn't a result of not feeling anger, not feeling frustration or anything like that, or trying to, like, keep bottling that or whatever, running away from it. It was a result of feeling it, and maybe I could have dealt with it a little bit better. Maybe I could have not let it consume me, but I definitely needed to feel it, and make something out of it. And I'm still making something out of it. But you're absolutely right. Yeah, it's perfectly okay to feel that. You know, of course, I would have liked to do that in the space of a therapist's office, but I didn't. and that's a regret.
Me too. Yeah.
But as a result of processing some of it, at least just taking the bandaid off and letting it come out, and actually seeing it with my eyes, like, oh, okay, like this, it's just kind of around me, so I could actually see what I was feeling, what I could actually see it exist in front of me, and I did a lot of writing, lots and lots of writing. Some voice memos, I got it out as much as possible. That became, like, I guess the healthiest way for me to deal with it. And from there, then I could actually make some type of changes. And I wish I had gone to a therapist, but
I think this is the one thing that I've found, and this isn't to cut you off, Bahailu. There's a lot of us, and this is a conversation that I have among some of our other adoptee friends more recently, honestly. And I think there's so much, like, pressure we put on ourselves that, like, we should have known better to have taken up, like therapy or something that's positive. Yeah. But at the end of the day, you know, you got to look at the fact that growing up, you know, we're trying to keep up with all these other quote unquote normal kids growing up in their environment. And I remember saying to my mom, I was like, I don't have time for that. Like, I don't, like, what is that going to do for me right now? God, you know? I think it's like remembering that we're still children at that time and acting like adults don't go to therapy if they're supposed to, you know? So definitely, like, cutting yourself some slack on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did attempt to go to therapy once or twice, but I just felt like this was going to be a waste of time.
Yeah.
I don't know. I wish I had found somebody that was a little bit more like me in some ways. So I kind of just gave up the search. I just kind of looked locally, and there wasn't going to be too many people, let alone therapists, that had similarities in terms of my story. And so I just felt like, okay, well, I might as well just try to figure this out on my own instead of trying to explain everything to somebody.
Right.
But that's kind of how therapy works. Like, you're supposed to try to explain it to somebody.
Right.
But yeah, you know, definitely right.
Can I ask you a question? So a lot of us, and don't feel pressure to say either way, right? Mm-hmm. But you were saying, you know, you kind of wish for somebody that, like, was in, like, a similar situation. So I know for myself for a while, there was on and off, you know, Betty being one of them, we know about her. She definitely was one of those people that, from a very young age, like fourth grade, like, she was my person that, like, always kind of understood. And I felt like she kept me so grounded through shit that, like, would have had me so gone, like not, like, so disconnected from myself. So what do you think about did the adoptee community of, you know, like, within, like, you know, Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, that area, like, did that help in any sort of way, like, you know, growing up?
It did. It did. I wish I'd opened up more to a lot of my friends from the community. But at least just having them around and doing things together, that was a real help because I didn't feel as alone here. Yeah, it did. I wish I had taken the time to open up and really process it. I think it's just because I didn't know yet, like, how I even felt about these things, so or what I would even say. And so there's a hesitancy for me, or there was, to not speak unless it was something that I kind of already, like, figured out.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of what had prevented me. And, yeah, I'm trying to do that now. Trying to just speak without figuring it out. And, yeah, kind of figure out as I go along. A Big Brother program for adopted Ethiopian teens that took place for a while, and I thought it was a great idea just because you had older members trying to just at least create the space, you know, provided some answers, but I think the more important thing is just creating the space for a lot of these conversations to take place. And I hope that that program is still running, or at least the members of it are still connected. And especially those teens, at least finding those people that they can talk to. Because I know there's a fair number of us.
Right. No, they really are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So kind of moving on. I guess this is the one question I really want to ask you, because people have written in, and, like, thank you again to those people that have, whether family, friends, adoptees, non-adoptees. And it's, a lot of it's been like, wow, like, I didn't know, like, I didn't, actually, one of my friends from school, he's from, like, the Bahamas, and he said to me, he's like, I didn't know that, I'd never really thought of adoption outside of the perspective of the people that were adopting you. So I just assumed that it was a good thing. And he's like, dang, like, I don't know. He said it was a trip. He was like, I had to sit here and, like, rethink about some things. So what do you think, if you have anything, what is, like, the biggest misconception about adoption that you're like, bro, this is not it? Even if you, like, subscribe to it at some point.
Yeah, it's not simple at all. It's super messy. It is super messy.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it.
And it's not just, you know, leaving one family and joining another. It's leaving a whole entire culture, language, everything. There's so many things that are kind of being replaced. And it's not just a simple transition from one family to another.
Mm.
And especially the in-between, the transitioning, that itself too. It's very, very messy, very, very complicated. So that's what I would say. That's what I would say.
Well, I think a lot of people would agree with you on that. If you could kind of tell your younger self, adoptee, something that you know now, because I think there might be younger individuals listening, like, what is that thing that you would say to them?
Don't chase the soccer ball.
I'm going to name this episode that. Don't chase the soccer ball.
Yeah. Enjoy it. Enjoy it, but don't chase the soccer ball, because it'll ruin it. Enjoy the soccer ball, but don't chase it. And so processing things as it comes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much
for doing this. It's not an easy conversation to have. And even as Bahailu's like telling his story, I'm thinking about my own, you know, and it's like an emotional roller coaster, even listening to, because some things I haven't heard before. So I'm like, dang, like you went through all that and you had the medical stuff and then your family's here and then they leave you, but then you want to get connected with them, but everybody else has time with them. I met your siblings. They're so stinking cute and super, super kind. Yeah. But like it's just such an emotional roller coaster. And it's not until you like actually go to think about it, you're like, how is it simplified my whole life? I mean, it sounds so simple, like you said, but it's super, I will say it again, it is so fucked up, because I hate having to be so PC, like, oh, it's a little, no, it is incredibly messy and fucked up. Yeah. But I do want to say, like, it's hard to come out here, you know, and just be so candid about your experience. So I thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me, and I know you're going to be very successful ahead, but we're all doing the work, so you're in good company.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, of course. So honestly, I don't want to add too much to what Bahailu has said. And all I can say is wow. And all I can say is thank you, Bahailu, for sharing that with all of us. It just gives all of us something to think about. And I again urge you to really reassess your definition of adoption. I want that for all of us to be a working definition, and a definition that, you know, stays available to edit and to adjust and to readjust and to forever adjust. And I think that's how we really should think about many things in our life. It's not fixed. It's not fixed. And I think if we want things to be fixed, we're missing out on the opportunity to really get a better grasp of what that thing is. And in this sense, it's adoption. And I think Bahailu's story, there are so many similarities with our stories, but there's also so many differences. And literally, obviously, like our stories themselves are very different. But the similarities, you know, like we can kind of pick them out. And some of that being, you know, adoptees have no freaking clue what's going on to the, like what's going on. It's interesting to me how Bahailu also said, when my parents and I were walking and then they kind of disappeared, he's like, I knew something was off. Because why were they there at the same time when I know they're usually working and they need to work? We all had, and in my case, it was my uncle and then our other relatives. And again, I knew, this is odd, we don't do this. It's, and even that alone is so messed up once you think about it. Especially the older you get and after the series of events that follow, you know. And that gut, I guess, you know, it's just, it knows something is wrong and something isn't right. And, you know, he was right. I was right. And I'm sure as we hear about from others, that might be a sad truth, you know? And it's so heart-wrenching, even though I've experienced it, hearing it from his perspective. It's so sad, because I know we were all so young, you know, and then we are taking that into our young adult life and then moving on, you know, but yeah. And then there's so many, you know, differences. And even with Bahailu's story and how he has a family, you know, his mom and dad and siblings, and he's living apart from that. I think for myself, and I don't want to say fortunate, because it does cause issues in other aspects of my life, but, you know, I know my parents are dead. As far as I know, I hope they didn't lie to me about that. But so it kind of puts to rest some of those things. But I think for me, I cannot imagine what that must be like, fully knowing that your family is alive and well and you're living somewhere else separate from them. And Bahailu, just, you can hear it in the interview, there's just so much emotion around that. and trying to understand it all, and I cannot even begin to unpack that. And so I am so grateful, Bahailu, again, thank you so much for taking the time to do this and to be so vulnerable and to be honest and to share all of that, and to even another thing I found really interesting is COVID. That was such a shared, you know, experience amongst all of us internationally. Of course, you know, I mean, the more privileged you are, you had a very different experience, of course. But, you know, in terms of adoption, you know, him talking about that soccer ball, which I think is such an important metaphor, how, you know, you chased it and you never stopped chasing it. And the only time you stopped chasing it was during COVID, and when you were forced to stop, when that no longer mattered, because soccer didn't matter. You couldn't go out there and play. And Bahailu was, you know, forced to really face himself, and, you know, that kind of closet I was talking about, he had to open it up and get to dealing with it, unfortunately. And I totally understand, because I during COVID I had similar things come up in my life, and I was forced to face things that I usually found a way to distract myself with. And maybe that's something we can think about in adoptees. Maybe that's something if you want to think about. What's your soccer ball? You know, maybe you can still learn to enjoy it. Don't chase it. Maybe just learn to enjoy it. And again, Pile, thank you for that honesty, you know. And I think and the last thing I want to say is I am so incredibly proud of all the adoptees that are in my life, and I'm sure even those that are listening, because I found that despite all of our stories, and, you know, and I've really heard varying ones, and they're all tragic to some extent, even in just in the fact that all of us just knowing that something was wrong and one thing after the next just drastically changing in our lives, you know, siblings leaving, parents leaving, this happened, and it was just never ending, it felt like. So we kind of constantly live on the edge of what's going to happen to me next, you know. And despite all that, you are all so incredibly resilient. You know, my friends are also incredibly resilient. They're so talented. They're so accomplished. And Bahailu didn't say this, you know, because I think he's humble. But even with soccer, I know the soccer was kind of the vessel that caught him through many aspects of his life. And he says that. But, like, you know, going through what he did at 12 and having the health crisis, which I didn't even realize was truly, it was life and death matter. I did not understand that at my age. I didn't understand that. And the older I got, I was like, wow, that's crazy. You know, so he didn't really get time to unpack the adoption thing. He's going through his medical, you know, his health issues, you know, life and death situation. And during that time, his past come to his present in a very important way, but he's not able to fully kind of engage in it because he's so sick, you know. And then he gets out of that and they have to go back home. And then he talks about having that drive, and he pulls through it, and he goes through to Phillips Exeter, which is a very prestigious high school kind of in the area. And it's very, very difficult to get into, and it's academically very difficult. So he was juggling sports in school. And then he went to Middlebury, another, you know, these higher institutions of education that are just very, very rigorous. And then he went to Columbia, and he graduated from there recently. And it's, I don't think he gives himself credit. I don't think adoptees give themselves credit. I've just talked to so many, and they are so driven in so many ways, and they've accomplished so much. And not to say that, you know, academia is the only area in which, you know, any sort of accomplishment should be measured against. Not at all. You know, it does not matter what it is. Even just doing well in life at all, being healthy, showing up, getting ready, you know, having friends, having any, like, even that's exhausting. Socializing, as Bahailu talked about. And I can't wait to really get into it. But there's so many little aspects of adoption that, like, even the socializing part where Bahailu was like, it was really difficult. It was so difficult. And again, I can't wait to get into it and give those topics the justice that they deserve, you know. But it's just despite all that, we are so accomplished in so many ways. And so I'm so very proud of all of you that are listening. I'm so proud of all my friends, because it would have been so much easier to go down some very dark, destructive paths. And somehow we've all managed to stay the route. So I'm just going to leave you with that. I'm going to ask you, maybe think about, if you want to, what's that soccer ball? Maybe you should stop chasing it and learn to enjoy it, as Bahailu said. And I will say to all of you that I've been receiving your questions. I cannot wait to answer them in an episode that I'm doing, that I'll be doing solo soon. And send those questions my way, and I'll do my best to answer them. Thank you all so much for, you know, your continued support and engaging with the content. And until next time, goodbye.